The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And our first item from the Week magazine today is entitled Herman Cain's Sexual Harassment Scandal, His Awful Damage Control. Herman Cain has been trying all week to deflect Politico's potentially devastating story about sexual harassment complaints that the GOP presidential hopeful faced more than a decade ago, but he seems to be making matters worse. After the story first broke late Sunday night, the GOP frontrunner's spokesman said Cain was only vaguely familiar with the entire episode. Then Cain said early Monday that he was aware of the allegations, but unaware of a financial settlement with one of the women. Then he contradicted himself hours later by estimating that his accuser received a settlement worth 2 or 3 months' salary. The candidate's confused response has commentators lining up to point out his errors. Here, 5 ways Cain blew it. Cain's campaign squandered its advance warning. It's not like Cain's organization was broadsided by this story, says Michael Brendan Daugherty and Zeke Miller at Business Insider. Before publishing its expose, Politico gave the campaign 10 days advance notice that it had uncovered the complaints from Cain's 90s tenure as head of the National Restaurant Association. But the campaign still did nothing to quash the scandal. That only confirms that Cain's organization is slow and disorganized, which is not going to impress conservatives looking for a candidate capable of beating President Obama in 2012. Secondly, his spokesman's initial response was horrible. Politico's story was a thinly sourced hit piece, says Ed Driscoll at Pajamas Media. A good campaign spokesman would get in journalists' faces and punch back twice as hard the way Bill Clinton did in 1992 to counter his myriad bimbo eruptions. But Cain's campaign spokesman could only offer pure dissembling that did nothing to stop his employer's potential hemorrhaging. His non-denial denial on Fox News on Sunday was flat-out awful. Reason number 3. Cain didn't deny the charges quickly enough. There was enough meat to the Politico report to demand a serious response from Cain, says Stephen Bennin at Washington Monthly. Yet when the candidate first addressed the charges himself, he didn't deny them outright, nor did his campaign's official statement, nor did his spokesman who appeared on Fox News. The Associated Press eventually got a denial, but it wasn't an especially strong one, and it came way too late to prevent the matter from blowing up. He sang by the time Cain appeared at the National Press Club on Monday. He had to know he had a full-fledged scandal on his hands, says Evan McMorris Santora at Talking Points Memo. So it's odd that he chose that moment to sing for the crowd, and he sang Amazing Grace, a hymn where he asked for forgiveness for his faults. Not a good choice. And reason number 5, Cain called his accusers liars. Once Cain finally got his story straight late Monday, says Ruth Marcus at the Washington Post, he insisted that he had been falsely accused and that an investigation proved the charges to be baseless. That was an unnecessarily dangerous tactic. It risks inflaming the women involved who signed confidentiality agreements and have so far stayed silent. Why would he do anything that urges them to speak out? The next item from the Week magazine today, the banks cave on credit card fees. Is this a victory for Occupy? Starting late last week, large banks began killing off new monthly fees for debit card holders. Chase and Wells Fargo were first, with the trend spreading to regional banks like SunTrust on Monday. Even Bank of America, whose $5 monthly fee stirred up widespread consumer outrage, appears to be backing off. Progressive bloggers are celebrating and crediting Occupy Wall Street for the change of heart, says Tim Mack at Politico. But is it really fair to score this a victory for the amorphous Occupy movement? Yes, give Occupy its victory lap. For a moment without an agenda, Occupy Wall Street is off to a pretty good start, says Dan Fried at The Street. Sure, the leaderless, agendaless occupiers didn't specifically demand that big banks abandon the credit card or the debit card fees, but it does not take a genius to figure out that this is the kind of greed occupiers are protesting against, and that the movement's glaring spotlight generated the needed heat to melt the bank's resolve. No, if anything, this should teach Occupy to change its tactics. This is a big victory for consumers, not occupiers, says Mike Gavin in the Wall Street Journal. In fact, the Wall Street protesters might be better served taking a lesson from the debit card debacle. Voting with your cash, as consumers did by threatening to withhold their business from big banks charging these fees, is more effective than camping out in a park. As the bank's quick surrender shows, the 1% is listening. You just have to know which ear is the good ear, and it's the one closest to the wallet. Occupy Wall Street is just one of the victors. If anyone deserves credit for the banks furiously backtracking on their fee, it's probably Bank of America, says David Dayan in Fire Dog Lake. The banking giant screwed with its customers just in time to run smack into the backlash against greedy banks from the Occupy Wall Street protests. B of A's $5 debit card fee single-handedly revived the Move Your Money movement, and other banks seem to be scrambling to hang on to their customers as a result. The banks will win in the end. There's no such thing as a free lunch, and the banks will certainly figure out another way to make this money, says John Byrne in the New York Post. A likely vehicle, the double-digit finance charges cardholders pay for bank-issued credit cards. So while the banks appear to be caving in to customer protests, most customers will pay for the conveniences of modern banking one way or the other. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for this week. Thanks so much for joining me today. Our next item is entitled Zombie Obama, a GOP group's disgusting email. Virginia Republicans apologize after sending a mailer depicting the president as a zombie with a bullet hole in his head. What were they thinking? A Halloween-themed mailer from Virginia's Loudoun County Republican Committee sparked bipartisan outrage this week for its gruesome rendering of President Obama as a zombie with a bullet hole in his head. The email, which invited supporters to the county's GOP's Halloween parade, also featured undead versions of Democratic voters and Nancy Pelosi, with the tagline, "We are going to vanquish the zombies with clear-thinking conservative principles and a truckload of Republican candy." The mailer has been condemned by the chairman of Virginia's Republican Party, and Republican Governor Bob McDonnell branded it as disgusting. The county committee has since apologized for the zombie Obama image, calling it a lighthearted attempt to inject satire humor into the Halloween holiday. The reaction? Have these people no sense? Says Andrew Belonsky at Death and Taxes. It's in the worst of taste, both morally and politically, to depict any politician with a gunshot wound, particularly after Representative Gabrielle Giffords was nearly killed by a bullet earlier this year. This is too gruesome for words. I guess I'm nearly impossible to offend, says David Weigel at Slate. The blog that first posted this image crashed under the weight of traffic from liberals who want to be pissed off about something. But I just don't see what the big deal is. Regardless, this zombie madness contributes heavily to my dislike for Halloween. The next item is entitled The Flu Shot, Six Dangerous Myths. Influenza kills tens of thousands of Americans each year, and yet just 42% of us plan on getting a flu shot this year. Why is that? It's time for your flu shot. The simple vaccine provides strong protections against a virus that can be lethal, and yet just 42% of Americans plan on getting a flu shot this year, according to USA Today. The flu kills more people in the U.S. every year than any other vaccine-preventable disease. So why do so many people opt out? Blame misinformation, say experts. So to clear things up, here are six dangerous myths about the flu and its vaccine, and brief explanations of why they're just not true. The first one, the flu is simply a bad cold. The common cold can be an annoyance, says Liz Sabo at the Chicago Sun-Times. The flu, on the other hand, can be deadly. According to the CDC, the virus kills up to 49,000 people a year. Just last year, 114 children died from it. Flu symptoms tend to appear suddenly, unlike a cold, she says. And unlike a cold, the flu can kill you. The flu shot can give you the flu. That's myth number two. This just isn't so, says Kenneth Tran at Montreal's Gazette. Even though 35% of consumers believe that the flu vaccine can lead to sickness, the viruses in the flu shot are dead, Tran says. At worst, you may experience a sore arm or a little fever as your body adapts to the virus. But it's impossible for you to get the full-blown flu from a flu vaccine. Myth number three. You don't need a flu shot if you got one last year. You need to get vaccinated every year, says ABC News, because the virus is constantly mutating. It isn't clear how long protection lasts, and most years the vaccine protects against different strains of flu than the year before. Myth number four. If you're healthy, you don't need a flu shot. Around 50% of consumers think flu shots are only for kids or sick people, says Sabo. But think about it. The most vulnerable potential flu victims, like newborns, are too weak for flu shots, and the only way to protect them is to vaccinate everyone around them. Myth number five, the shot causes autism. Roughly 14% of consumers think the flu shot is dangerous. They are wrong. Their fears are likely a result of the fact that a preservative called thimerosal was once commonly used in vaccines, but thimerosal was all but phased out in 2001. Plus, there isn't even any real evidence linking thimerosal to autism or multiple sclerosis. And myth number six, the flu shot is a vast conspiracy. Some people seem to think the flu shot is part of an elaborate and diabolical partnership between pharmaceutical companies and politicians. Well, that's nonsense, says Tran. Flu viruses are a major liability to both the public and the health of the economy. The costs associated with an influenza pandemic largely surpass the cost of a vaccination program. That's why everyone encourages you to get one. And now we'll turn to the section of the Week magazine called Health and Science, sort of an elaboration on the article there about the flu shots. The first item is New Hope for People Who Are Paralyzed. Within the next 3 years, quadriplegics may learn to walk. Excuse me, this is quadriplegics. I think there's a misspelling here. It's kind of confusing me. Within the next 3 years, quadriplegics may learn to walk again by moving a full-body prosthetic device with their minds alone. A team of neuroscientists has taken a giant step toward that goal by teaching monkeys to use their thoughts to operate a virtual arm that sends feedback directly to the brain about the texture of things they touch. The new technology could allow paralyzed patients to get sensations back from their legs, arms, and hands. Duke University researcher Miguel Nicellis tells the London Guardian that sensory feedback is crucial for all kinds of movement, from walking over rocky terrain to grasping a coffee cup. To achieve it, he and his colleagues implanted electrodes in the sensory and motor regions of the monkeys' brains and attached them to a computer. When a monkey thought about moving its virtual arm, its motor cortex sent signals to the computer to move the limb on screen. When the arm touched an object, the computer sent return pulses to the sensory cortex. Slow pulses indicated a rough surface, faster pulses a smooth one. The technology may lead to the development of a motorized full-body exoskeleton that provides sensory feedback, enabling paralyzed people to walk. The next item from Health and Science, a stem cell breakthrough. A new cloning technique has enabled scientists to turn adult human stem cells into more useful embryonic stem cells. A breakthrough that opens a path to using a patient's own tissue to grow new organs. In the new technique, scientists insert the nucleus from a patient's skin cell into an unfertilized egg, which then generates embryonic stem cells that bear the donor's genetic signature. The process works only when the egg retains its original nucleus, however, so the resulting embryo has an extra set of chromosomes and is not viable for the long term. It's an early research step towards curing devastating diseases, Dieter Egli of the New York Stem Cell Foundation Laboratory tells the Wall Street Journal. He and his team have yet to figure out how to remove the extra set of chromosomes, and some experts have expressed ethical concerns about using human eggs, for which female donors are paid to create embryos destined only for therapeutic use. But scientists say that cloning embryonic stem cells with adult genetic material will make it possible to create healthy organs and tissue to treat or cure diabetes, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, and other illnesses with minimal risk of rejection. For the first time, we have an experiment that works, says Egli. The technical hurdles can be overcome. The next item is entitled The Perks of Envy. Feeling envious may be unpleasant, but it does offer some advantages, the New York Times reports. Psychologists asked college students to write about instances when they'd coveted something belonging to a friend, and then tested their reading comprehension skills. The students who recalled envy were much better at remembering the details of what they read than students who hadn't done the exercise. Subsequent tests showed that volunteers paid closer attention to stories about people they envied than they did to stories about people they didn't. The results suggest that envy heightens our powers of memory and observation. We can't get our minds off people who have advantages we want for ourselves, said Sarah Hill of Texas Christian University. It's much like a car crash we can't stop looking at. That single-minded focus may help us learn how to imitate or sabotage people we envy in order to win some of their success. But coveting also takes up a lot of energy. Reading about classmates who were rich and good-looking made students quicker to give up on tasks that required prolonged mental effort, like completing puzzles. The next item from the Health and Science section, crickets' lesson in gallantry. Male crickets will risk their lives to protect females, suggesting that chivalry confers an evolutionary edge. Researchers videotaped crickets in the wild for thousands of hours and discovered that if a predator attacks a cricket couple, the male will wait until his partner reaches the safety of a burrow before taking cover himself. That makes male cricket escorts four times as likely to get eaten as single crickets, but guarantees that partnered females are six times less likely to meet that fate. The consequences of this chivalrous behavior are the same for men and crickets, Rolando Rodriguez Munoz of the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom tells USA Today. Both can get more matings and increase their paternity. Female crickets are more attracted to protectively minded males who reap an evolutionary benefit from making the ultimate sacrifice. If they can save a female that is carrying their sperm, they ensure that their genes will be passed on to future generations. And the final article from the Health and Science section this week is the health scare of the week, the downside of multivitamins. Taking over-the-counter nutritional supplements may do more harm than good. A new study shows that many common supplements, including multivitamins, folic acid, magnesium, iron, and zinc, do nothing to lengthen the lives of those who take them and may actually be shortening them. After following nearly 39,000 women aged 55 and older for almost 20 years, researchers found that those who regularly took multivitamins, something many doctors recommend to their patients, were 2.4% more likely to die of any cause over that period than those who didn't. Iron appeared to be especially dangerous. The more of it women took, the more lethal its effects. Only calcium supplements were found to actually reduce death rates slightly. University of Minnesota researcher Jaco Mirsu tells Reuters that while the study didn't explain why vitamins might be having a negative health impact, it did lead him to a simple piece of dietary advice. Eat as many vegetables and as much fruit as you can. Natural foods provide all the vitamins people need, Mirsu says, with no negative impact on longevity. You're listening to our reading of the Week magazine from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks for joining me today. Now we're going to turn to the business section of the Week magazine for the news at a glance. The first item here is entitled, Wall Street, Record Sentence for Insider Trading. A virus in our business culture that needs to be eradicated. That's what a New York federal judge called insider trading last week as he sentenced billionaire Raj Rajaratnam to 11 years in prison, the longest term ever imposed in an insider trading case, said Susan Pulliam and Chad Bray in the Wall Street Journal. Rajaratnam, 54, the former head of hedge fund Galleon Group, was convicted in May of securities fraud and conspiracy in a probe that has resulted in more than two dozen convictions. Prosecutors said Rajaratnam made more than $70 million through illegal tips from corporate insiders and corrupt traders. He was also hit with a $10 million fine and ordered to forfeit nearly $54 million. The prison sentence doesn't have the symbolic heft of the 19 to 24 years prosecutors requested, said Peter Latman in the New York Times, but it continues a trend of ever stiffer penalties against white-collar criminals, and Wall Street seems to have taken notice of the tough punishment and the government's use of hardball tactics, like wiretapping, to bring down a major hedge fund manager. These heavy sentences do send a powerful message, said former federal prosecutor Jonathan New. The next item from the business section, publishing. Amazon muscles out book publishers. Amazon has a message for book authors. Ditch your publisher, said David Streitfeld in the New York Times. The e-commerce giant is aggressively wooing top writers to bypass traditional publishing houses and publish their work directly with Amazon. The only real necessary people in the publishing process now are the writer and the reader, says Amazon executive Russell Grandinetti. In a striking acceleration of the company's ambitions, it will release more than 120 original books this fall, direct from authors. Publishers are terrified, said Dennis Lloyd Johnson of independent publisher Melville House. The next item, free trade. Congress okays trade agreements. Congress has approved the most significant expansion of trade relations in nearly two decades, said Zachary A. Goldfarb and Lori Montgomery in the Washington Post. Lawmakers last week passed long-stalled free trade agreements with South Korea, Panama, and Colombia, despite U.S. labor unions' protests that the pacts would cost jobs. The Latin American deals will likely have limited economic impact, but advocates say the agreement with South Korea could create up to 280,000 U.S. jobs by making it easier for U.S. automakers and farmers to sell products in the world's 15th biggest economy. The next item, telecom, the end of cell phone bill shock. The days of sticker shock from your cell phone bill could be coming to an end, says Jim Puzangara in the Los Angeles Times. Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, and T-Mobile have agreed to alert customers when they approach monthly usage limits so they can avoid hefty and unexpected phone charges. Customers will also be notified when they exceed their plan's allowances or are about to incur expensive international roaming fees. The alerts, which the telecom industry proposed under the threat of new government regulations, should begin within 18 months. And the next item, unemployment. Veterans hit harder than civilians. Many veterans are making the painful discovery that their military training means little to civilian employers, says Michael Fletcher in the Washington Post. The jobless rate among veterans is 11.7%, higher than the overall rate of 9.1%. The White House wants to give firms tax credits of up to $9,600 a year for each vet they hire. But such incentives don't solve the problem that employers often have only the vaguest notion of what people learn in the military. And McDonald's is adding TV to its menu. McTV is here, and in high definition, too, said Greg Braxton and Joe Flint in the Los Angeles Times. McDonald's will soon roll out its own television channel, first in 800 outlets in California and then across the U.S. In a bid to speak directly to customers in the digital age, McDonald's has customized programming for different locations, including local news, profiles of local high school athletes, and segments featuring local women juggling home life with careers. McDonald's recognizes that it has a captive audience, says brand consultant Alan Adamson. And while diners are in line getting their hamburger, there's no escape. McTV is part of a corporate strategy to convince customers that the chain is not just a place to grab a quick bite. Outlets are becoming more of a destination, says McDonald's spokeswoman Dania Proud. Now, from the Talking Points section, we'll turn to the issue of the week, the great BlackBerry outage. BlackBerry, you're dead to me, said Jim Kerstetter in CNET.com. A nearly four-day outage affecting tens of millions of customers on five continents was the last straw. I've stuck up for you for years, enduring taunts from my iPhone-carrying wife and giggles from coworkers who called me a fuddy-duddy. Sure, you're not terribly stylish brick, but the important thing was that you worked. Until just a couple of weeks ago, that is. So now I'm looking for a new phone and not in the BlackBerry section. BlackBerry customers everywhere are bound to do the same, said Ian McKenzie in BBCNews.com. Research in Motion's smartphone always stood first and foremost for reliability. It was like Volvo. Chunky, a little uncool, but you could drop a piano on one and it would keep on trucking. That reputation has now been tarnished as the worst possible moment as Apple and Android stand ready to embrace fed-up former CrackBerry addicts. RIM's biggest weakness hasn't been a failure to innovate, but a chronically limp response to crisis situations. Its deafening silence last week, followed by confused explanations and a belated apology from the CEO, simply doesn't inspire confidence. The company is alienating lots of its old friends. There's no better example of RIM's poor communication than its $100 in free apps peace offering for this debacle, said John Brotkin in ArsTechnica.com. Sorry, but free copies of Bejeweled and The Sims 3 won't be enough to make up for the worst crisis in RIM's 12-year history, especially as the outage seems so symbolic of the company's slow downfall. For years, RIM was the preferred provider for big business because it was stable and safe. But now the iPhone, Android, and other smartphone platforms are good enough for most business scenarios. That competition and RIM's mistakes had put the company's future in jeopardy even before last week's outage. RIM smartphones no longer seem very smart, said Jason Ponton in the Financial Times. Consumers want phones that are more than just messaging machines. They want to read news, listen to music, and watch videos, and doing those things on a BlackBerry is unpleasant. The business-oriented BlackBerry was supremely adapted to the early smartphone market, but phones now need to appeal first to consumers. That's the Darwinian business of technology. I suppose that BlackBerry could still adapt, but I doubt it. The next item is entitled Making Money. Here's what the experts have to say. The right time to refinance. If you're thinking of refinancing to take advantage of historically low mortgage rates, you might want to wait a little longer, said Jessica Silver Greenberg in the Wall Street Journal. Since refinancing involves costs that average 2% of a mortgage's value, you need to think hard about whether to leap at today's low rates, even those hovering around 4%, or whether to hold out for a further decline. Economists at the University of Chicago have created an online calculator that factors in closing costs, marginal tax rates, and the number of years left on the mortgage to produce personalized optimal refinancing rates. If you're worried that rates won't drop to your ideal level, your best bet is to negotiate hard on fees. The next item is entitled Stay Away from Layaway. Retailers like Walmart, Sears, and Toys R Us are bringing back layaway programs for the holidays, but consumers would be wise to shun them, says Lewis Hyman in the New York Times. The financing involved is decidedly worse than most credit cards, and many shoppers end up paying rates we could consider predatory. Take a mother who buys $100 worth of toys on layaway. She pays a $10 down payment and a $5 service fee, and then pays off the rest between now and the holidays. Ultimately, she's paying $5 in interest for a $90 loan for 2 months, the equivalent of a credit card rate with 44% annual percentage. Retailers like to say layaway programs give budget-conscious shoppers more choice, but in reality, they take advantage of strapped consumers' desperation. The next item is a bountiful harvest in farm stocks. Agribusiness companies look ripe for the picking, says Jay Palmer in Barron's. The need to feed billions of additional mouths in the coming decades makes a bullish case for agriculture investments like seed companies, crop producers, and farm equipment manufacturers. After a bruising third quarter across the market, giant commodities processors like Bunge and Archer Daniels, Midland, look relatively cheap, and their fortunes are poised to improve on rising global food demand. Similarly, farm equipment companies such as AGCO and Deere, which are benefiting from overseas growth and rising farm income in the U.S., could drive away with big gains. We are having our best year in the history of the company, Deere CEO Sam Allen says. Now let's take a look at some of the best columns in the business section there in the United States this past week, according to The Week magazine. The first one is entitled, Why There Won't Be a Double Dip. Neil Irwin in The Washington Post is the writer. Recent economic signs are not pointing to a recession, said Neil Irwin, but that's not because of any new evidence of resilience in the U.S. economy. It's because many vulnerable sectors are already at such low levels they don't have much more room to fall. Businesses have trimmed so much fat that they simply can't cut further, and neither can consumer budgets. Of course, a major shock like a big default in Europe could pull us back toward recession. But on our own, it's hard to get lower than we already are. Take housing. At the peak of the boom, Americans spent more than $800 billion a year on housing investments. Last year, they spent $327 billion. Mathematically, it would be impossible for a new housing downturn to be as powerful an economic drain now as it was over the past several years. There isn't $500 billion worth of housing activity left to vanish. The same dynamic applies to auto sales and other sectors. The economy is so lean right now that its only likely course is continued, albeit slow, growth. The next item is entitled How to Fix the Housing Mess, written by Martin Feldstein in the New York Times. It's time to act, said Martin Feldstein. Nearly 15 million homeowners owe more on their mortgages than their homes are worth. And our economy will not recover until they can get out from under that burden and start spending again. Washington has been understandably reluctant to help because taxpayers don't want to reward banks that made bad loans or homeowners who could simply walk away by defaulting. But there is a way out that would require both banks and homeowners to make sacrifices. The government could reduce the mortgage principal on underwater homes to 110% of a home's value. The government would absorb half the cost of the voluntary reduction and the bank the other half. In exchange, the borrower would accept that his non-housing assets could be seized if he defaulted on the reduced mortgage payments. This approach would cost about $350 billion, but it will be even costlier to do nothing. Just as we wouldn't allow a forest fire that threatens a neighborhood to burn out naturally, we can't let housing prices continue to fall and make the economy weaker and the loss of jobs much greater. And the next item is entitled Hold the Line on Insider Training by Larry Harris in the Los Angeles Times. Don't let anyone tell you we can't do without insider trading laws, said Larry Harris. Hedge fund tycoon Raj Rajaratnam, whose article we read about just a little while ago, his record prison sentence last week for profiting on illegal trading tips has given some people a renewed chance to argue that acting on inside information isn't all that bad. It makes prices more informative of a stock's true value, they like to say. The free market should run freely, and after all, how do you draw the line between smart research and illegal information? They even argue that insider trading wouldn't hurt shareholders in the long run. If it were considered a kind of employment benefit for executives that allowed corporations to pay them less. Fortunately, all of these arguments are readily rebutted. There is no doubt that most people believe that insider trading is simply unfair. But more importantly, insider trading gives those in the know incentives to hide information from corporate boards and from the public to maximize their own trading profits. The financial crisis uncovered devastating problems with financial disclosure and corporate governance. Eliminating insider trading rules would only make them worse. And now let's turn to the People's section of the Week magazine for this week. The first item here is about the gossip in Hollywood. Hollywood may have a new Brad and Jen to follow, said People.com. Rumors are heating up that Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lopez are dating after the Hangover star, who is 36, and the singer and American Idol judge, who is 42, were spotted for the second time in as many months. Last month, the two dined together in New York City. After their date in New York, Bradley and Jennifer stayed in touch, said a close source to Lopez. She likes him. Lady Gaga has it bad for Bill Clinton, said the New York Post. The pop singer, 25, seductively serenaded the former president last week at his 65th birthday celebration at Los Angeles Hollywood Bowl. After dancing suggestively in front of Clinton and altering the lyrics to her song Bad Romance to Bill Romance, Gaga swooned for the former commander-in-chief. I'm having my first Marilyn moment, joked the singer. I always wanted to have one, and I was hoping that it didn't involve pills and a strand of pearls. Rumors that Beyoncé is faking her pregnancy spread last week after the singer's baby bump appeared to deflate when she seated herself on an Australian talk show, said RadarOnline.com. The suggestion that she was wearing padding added to rumors that she and her husband Jay-Z have hired a surrogate to have their child, which is due in February. A rep for Beyoncé called the fake baby bump rumors stupid, ridiculous, and false. And Steven Seagal is patrolling the border, said TMZ.com. The former action star, 59, was sworn in last weekend as a sheriff's deputy in Hudspeth County, Texas, and plans to work full-time to help secure the border between the United States and Mexico. It became very clear to me that Mr. Seagal is not in this for the celebrity or the publicity, said Sheriff Arvin West. He's like the rest of us that live down here. He has a sincere passion for this country, and he wants to do more to help. Now, from the Week magazine this week, we'll turn to a section called The Best Columns in the International Media Space here. And this first title is How They See Us, Concocting an Iranian Plot. Here comes another in the long line of U.S. lies, said Mohammad Safari in Tehran, Siyat-e Rus. First, we saw the so-called attacks of 9/11, in which the U.S. struck itself and blamed terrorists in order to provide a pretexting for invading Afghanistan. Then came the lie of Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, which became the excuse for invading Iraq. And now the U.S. has conjured up a story about an Iranian plot to kill the Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Adel Abjaber. Why now? Because the Americans are desperate to deflect attention from the Occupy Wall Street movement that has the country under siege. More than 1,000 U.S. cities are participating in the people's protests against the policies of the ruling government. The far-fetched plot revealed last weekend, which entails at least two Iranians conspiring with a Mexican hitman to commit terrorism on U.S. soil, has been scripted to simply change the subject. The timing is indeed curious, said the Tehran Mardam Salari in an editorial. The news that two Iranian citizens have been indicted comes just a few weeks after Iran released two U.S. citizens who had been caught near the Iraqi border and claimed to be hikers. Could the trumped-up terror plot be payback for Iran's holding of the two? Or is it related to Iran's success at the UN, Askaveh Afrasabi, and the London Middle East Online.com? Iran has recently made genuine overtures toward a reasonable resolution of the nuclear standoff, expanding its cooperation with the UN's nuclear agency, and even offering to suspend uranium enrichment. How convenient that the U.S. now has the manna from heaven of the foiled plot to use as an excuse to push for further international isolation of Iran. It's not only the U.S. that benefits from this accusation, says Sayed Hamid Hosseini in the Mashhad, Iran Khorasan News. It's highly possible that the Saudi government played a role in concocting the scenario. After all, while the Arab Spring hasn't yet reached Saudi Arabia, there have been sporadic protests in areas populated by the Shiite minority. It would be most convenient for the Saudis to be able to blame those protests on Iranian provocation, citing the U.S. plot as part of a pattern of Iranian hostility. Then the regime would have reason to harshly suppress the protesters. Unfortunately, the plot seems to be all too real, said Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, Al Jazeera. Iran's international terrorist activities are well known, and the pattern of paying local criminals to carry out its dirty work fits too. That's what Iran has done in past operations all over the world, including in Argentina, Germany, Kuwait, Egypt, Morocco, and Bahrain. The motive is also obvious. The assassination of our diplomat on U.S. soil would surely have caused a crack in Saudi-U.S. ties. Iran has always been jealous of Saudi Arabia's preeminent role in the region, said the Jeddah Saudi Gazette. It will not give up its vicious efforts to destabilize its neighbors. Only a firm international response can obtain it. And here's an item from Canada in this section, and this is a section of columns from different countries, and it's entitled How They See Us Here in the United States. This one is from Canada. The article is entitled A Court That Treats Us Like Children by John Robson in the Ottawa Sun. Canada's Supreme Court is poised to rob us of our last shred of free speech, said John Robson. It ought to be a given that free speech includes the right to be loathsome. Yet the justices are seriously pondering whether anti-gay flyers distributed by William Watcott in Saskatchewan a decade ago constitute hate speech. Watcott's flyers called gay sex filthy and sick. That was certainly impolite. But was it really hateful? Even if it were, the best way to combat false or malicious speech is not for, or is for, rational people to rebut it in an open debate. Our top court, though, doesn't think Canadians are capable of having such a debate. In the last major ruling on free speech in 1990, the court said that because individuals can be persuaded to believe almost anything, the government can't simply allow an unregulated marketplace of ideas. Some must be suppressed. So what is the harm that is so grave that it justifies suppressing this idea? The complainants have alleged nothing more serious than hurt feelings. Please, if you crumble at a rude word from some random loser, you have problems no hate speech judgment can begin to address. Now we'll turn to some talking points here from the Week magazine for this week. The first item is entitled, One University's Ultimatum, Reject Homosexuality or Get Fired. A fundamentalist Christian school is making employees sign a pledge not to stray from what the college says the Bible teaches. Is that legal? Shorter University, a Baptist college in Georgia, is requiring employees to sign a document rejecting homosexuality. Shorter President Don Dallas says people who don't comply could lose their jobs. Here's what you should know. What is this university up to? Well, it's trying to purge its staff of gay employees, but that's only part of the story. Shorter's Board of Trustees is demanding that all 200 of the university's employees sign a personal lifestyle statement, promising to abstain from any behavior prohibited by the Bible, as the Georgia Baptist Convention interprets it. Not only is homosexuality forbidden, but so is premarital sex, adultery, drug use, and drinking. Anything outside that is not biblical. We do not accept, Dallas said. Why now? The fundamentalist Georgia Baptist Convention won a court case in 2005, giving it total control over Shorter, including the right to name all the members of the Board of Trustees, according to the Georgia-based Baptist Today. Ever since, the trustees have been trying to bring the school's policies in line with the Georgia Baptist Convention's mission. The new personal behavior policies and an oath of loyalty approved last week were merely a visible, controversial example of that change. How has the policy been received? Well, the reaction has been decidedly mixed. One closeted gay Shorter employee told the Georgia Voice that most elements of the new policies seem reasonable enough. Any employer wants loyal employees, but singling out gays raised the possibility of witch hunts. A group of Shorter graduates, current students who don't have to take the pledge, and former faculty members have launched a petition protesting the policy. They plan to hold a demonstration this month, but Dowla says it's perfectly reasonable and legal since the private school receives no federal funding for a religious school to expect its employees to follow its mission. We have a right to hire only Christians, he tells the Christian Post. Our next item from the Talking Point section, will YouTube replace television? The web video site ventures into original programming by partnering with celebrities like Madonna and Deepak Chopra to launch 100 new channels. YouTube may be the top destination for videos of cats playing the piano, but could it be a threat to television? Google is betting it is. The company has announced that YouTube, which Google owns, is partnering with Madonna, Ashton Kutcher, Amy Poehler, The Onion, Slate, and others to launch 100 new online channels with exclusive original programming, a deal reportedly worth $100 million. The first channel is expected to launch this month. Google is also updating Google TV to offer an easier way to access the new YouTube channels. Is this the first step toward making YouTube a replacement for cable TV? Google may be onto something. The traditional TV industry should consider itself warned, says Matt Rozoff at Business Insider. As more and more programming migrates online, TV is changing from a world of a few hundred channels to millions of channels available via the web. Google is smart to capitalize on that movement, and the Google TV link will put the YouTube programming on equal footing with cable shows. Make no mistake, Google is taking on the TV industry. All it needs is one success. YouTube's problem has been that skateboarding chicken videos aren't necessarily what most people look for when they settle in on the couch for the evening, says Michael Hogan at MoviePhone. But a skateboarding channel programmed by Tony Hawk might be. Even if 90% of these channels fail, Google's investment will pay off if one or two can build a loyal audience, bypassing the gatekeepers of broadcast and cable television. There is no way this will work. It's hard to imagine YouTube becoming a viable alternative for television, says Mac Rawdon at Cinema Blend. It just doesn't have enough substance, and it still won't even with these new channels. Every year, hundreds of schemes and inventions are touted as waves of the future. Like most of them, this experiment will probably be written off as costly and foolish within a year. The next item, what is the McRib made of anyway? The popular McDonald's sandwich is back. Find out what's inside, if you dare. McDonald's McRib and its cult-like following are back. Thank goodness the disconcerting sandwich is only returning for a limited time only, says Meredith Melnick at Time. Because if you knew about all the unpronounceable ingredients packed into the McRib, you might think twice about wolfing down the sauce-drenched pork concoction. Think you can stomach what's inside? Read on. How many ingredients are there? At face value, the sandwich contains just pork, onions, and pickle slices slathered in barbecue sauce and laid out on a bun. But the truth is there are roughly 70 ingredients. The bun alone contains 34, says Times Melnick. In addition to chemicals like ammonium sulfate and polysorbate 80, the most egregious may be azodicarbonate, a flour bleaching agent most commonly used in the manufacturing of foamed plastics like gym mats and the soles of shoes. According to McDonald's own ingredients list, the bun also includes calcium sulfate and ethoxylated mono and diglycerides, among other chemicals. Oof, what is the meat made of? Pig innards and plenty of salt. Typically, restructured meat product includes big bits like tripe, heart, and scalded stomach, says Wet Moser at Chicago Magazine, citing a 1995 article by Robert Mandigo, a professor at the University of Nebraska. These parts are cooked and blended with salt and water to extract salt-soluble proteins, which act as a glue that helps bind the reshaped meat together. Is it really that bad for you? Well, it's certainly not good for you, though slightly trimmer than the Big Mac, which contains 540 calories and 29 grams of fat, says Christina Rexroad at USA Today. The McRib, first introduced in 1982, still packs in 500 calories and 26 grams of fat. And despite its name, one thing you won't find inside a McRib is bones. The absence of any detectable rib is what gives the unnutritious mush its quirky sense of humor, says Marta Farron, McDonald's U.S. Marketing Director. And as we reach the final few minutes of our program, let's take a look at a few short items from the column entitled The Bottom Line. Prepare to shell out more money for peanut butter this fall. A smaller-than-expected U.S. peanut crop has pushed wholesale peanut prices to nearly $1,200 a ton, up from about $450 a ton last year. As a result, major peanut butter brands like Jif and Planters will soon be between 30 and 40% more expensive at the supermarket. Midwesterners lead the nation in healthy credit scores. 8 of the 10 cities with the highest average credit scores are in the Midwest, including Minneapolis, Madison, Wisconsin, and Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The top performer, Wausau, Wisconsin, population 40,000, with an average credit score of 789. Step aside, Ted Turner. Media baron John Malone, the owner of Liberty Media, is now the single largest landowner in America, with 2.2 million acres, the equivalent of almost 3 Rhode Islands. The number of wireless devices in the U.S., such as smartphones and tablets, now exceeds the number of Americans in the country. And finally, police in Dubai say last week's BlackBerry outage that we talked about earlier made the Emirates road safer. Traffic accidents in Dubai fell 20% on days when BlackBerry service was disrupted. In Abu Dhabi, accidents fell 40%. Police say the declines occurred because people were unable to use their smartphones while driving. There's probably a message there for all of us. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We certainly hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.